Welcome to the BFM Historical Society. This week, we talk to Owen Harris, the host of the Wednesday Night Special for 12 years, and for the last 9 years, something of a frequent BFM foreign correspondent. Owen tells us that even after 25 years, he still hasn't found a better forum for new music. Well, first off, I'd like to say welcome to the BFM Historical Society, Owen Harris.
Cheers, Dubby. Good to be here.
Very good to have you. A brief trip into the country. Now, first off, tell us when you got involved in BFM and how that came about.
Going back quite a few haircuts now, I suppose. 1988 would be when I started at the B and came about through one of my ex-Penrose High colleagues inviting one of the then BFM DJs to come in and judge a talent quest. He got involved with the station, only ended up doing two or three graveyards. I got involved at the time, came in, saw Dom Nola. She said, yep, stick you on a graveyard, see how you go. And pretty much snowballed from there. There wasn't that much DJ availability at the time. Didn't help my studies all, but definitely helped the musical education.
What were you studying at university?
Nominally started off doing an engineering degree. Found out after the first year that that wasn't really me. Ended up moving into science, doing the old maths, physics, chemistry. But honestly, BFM became the hangout of the time and ended up becoming quite a drawn-out degree, although I did eventually graduate with it. But yeah, it was great camaraderie, and you see a lot of the same people around these days, you know, Renee, et cetera, still working at the station, the likes of yourself still involved. And, you know, you see the old alumni out there doing whatever, made great careers, not necessarily in radio, audio, video, but music-related in some way, it seems.
And what were the shows that you were doing, or what was the one that kind of lasted the longest for you?
Well, definitely a variety. Started off doing three or four graveyards, then, as I said, moved on to the daytimes, and it was generally early afternoon, whatever fitted with my studies, so a couple of afternoons a week. Then gradually morphed into doing the Wednesday special quite frequently. At some stage it was the Sunday special, Sunday night surprise, that sort of thing, became the Wednesday night special, but it was basically any of the BFM alumni or guests could come up, choose a subject, a label, a band, someone that was touring, do an interview, play some songs, take questions, etc. If you had a guest in the studio, you know, very frequently. So, you know, my taste, as with most of the people, pretty diverse. So never a dull moment as far as I was concerned at what I could do. And, you know, that, the idea of getting into that really for me came about early high school years. I guess that was back when BFM was not BFM, it was campus radio and it was AM. And myself and one of my friends from Penrose High, Android, have no idea what she's doing these days, had a great mohawk though, used to listen to the B in the late hours of the evening, and the Joy Division, I think it was the second anniversary of Ian Curtis's death, came on. And there was just this great retrospective of what then was only 2 or 3 year old music being played. A lot of knowledge, a lot of rare tracks, and I thought, you know, that sort of stuff sounds great. Love to get involved in that, and eventually it did come about. What I found was it was actually unbelievable the amount of artists that did come down, and unfortunately a lot of great would have been concerts were cancelled because of the usual Kiwi leave it to the last minute to buy tickets. So Husker Du was one of my great regrets that I never got to see down here, even though they were threatening to two or three times. Although Bob Mould did grace us, 91, came up, did a great show at the Glue Pot. Chris Knox, Martin Phillips, all solo guitars. But, you know, having the Buzzcocks hanging around the studio. Marcus Lush with Dinosaur Jr. up here. I was up here that night and we got them plastered on a selection of New Zealand beer from the fridge. Having Joey Ramone standing around the lobby. Stuff you couldn't really read about or invent.
It just happened
day to day, you know.
2.5 hours, but still
being involved with BFM gave you great access to who was around. So that, yeah, again, definitely eternally thankful for. Yeah. Yeah, and you know, some of my favorite bands still New Zealand bands from back in the day. Again, some of the bands that got me interested in BFM when it was an AM station, listening to, I think the Abel Tasmans would be the most seminal as far as that's concerned, way back on their first Tired Sun EP. You know, Snow White Chook for me was the one that's really stands out. You know, I love the rest of the Flying Nun stuff that I've heard. That one really stuck out and I stuck with that band as much as any. One of my all-time favourite Kiwi bands, the Abel Tasmans. It's from their first EP, The Tired Sun, from 1985. Snow White Chook. Thank you.
There we go, Abel Tasman's. Wow, that was nice. Now, tell us a little bit about your birthday, 2009.
I have one every year, but this one in particular, that was the 40th anniversary, along with BFM, of my birth, strangely enough. And I was most fortunate and grateful to be able to coerce Graham Humphreys, Peter Keane, Leslie Yonkers, Jane Dodd, Craig Mason, collectively known as the Abel Tasmans in most incarnations, to play my birthday party, although it was not advertised as such, sort of a private slash word of mouth gig. Also featured the first and only performance to date of Humphreys and Keane, Graham and Peter's offshoot. Brilliant album, The Overflow, from 2006. Go buy it. But what a great night. I mean, perfect for me. Matthew Bannister from Sneaky Feelings, The Weather, Dribbling Darts opening. Abel Tasman, then Humphreys and Keane, and to cap it all off in more ways than one, George D. Henderson, Gavin and Ian, collectively known as The Puddle, to close it out. So
I wish I'd known about that gig. It's a great lineup there.
It was amazing the word of mouth that did go around, considering it was nominally a private gig or whatever, get-together. You know, a lot of friends, family, but just people coming out of the woodwork. Great way to catch up with a lot of old faces all at once and hopefully enjoy a beautiful night's music.
And with the music on show, it's almost like a time capsule.
Oh, it was. It was a complete flashback. It was 10 years plus since the Abel Tasmans played their last gig, which was again at the King's Arms. Humphreys and Keane had never played. I'd never been able to catch The Puddle, and good to catch up with Matthew Bannister as well. Hadn't seen him for quite a while.
Now, let's talk about the Wednesday special again. Can you tell me some of your highlights, some of the ones that particularly went down well?
There's a lot going around, and more than I can shake a stick at. So the Abel Tasmans was one when they did break up the first time around, for good, I guess. And again, they broke up not because of musical differences. It was just, you know, they got on great as friends, and the drinking became more of a social thing than playing music at practices. Had a great two-week special of Motown around the early 90s when the two Motown box sets came out. Ronald LaPred, bass player from the Commodores, lives in Auckland, came up, co-hosted. Great anecdotes from his time at Motown playing with the Commodores. Their first tour was opening for the Jackson 5, you know, personal memories of Michael Jackson, etc. Hanging out with Diana Ross and being asked by her to break into her house in Beverly Hills in the middle of the night because she'd forgotten her keys, that sort of thing. The Who, Paul Kelly, Ronnie Jordan, you know, the list goes on and on. There was many, many again, too many to shake a stick at.
And like you said, you would often get a guest in or a specialist in, depending on who the band was that you were covering.
So, yeah.
Like you said, there were a lot of BFM people coming up in there. I think Psychoff also got involved at some point, but was that when it became the Sunday special?
Oh, I think it was the Sunday night special first, and then it went into the Wednesday night special. But the show seemed to hang around for a while, and it definitely wasn't a monopoly by me. I just seemed to be able to fill the gaps when no one else was available. And again, it was great listening pleasure for myself. I mean, Psychoff, again, very broad and deep knowledge of music, so always interesting to hear what he's got to say, what he's got to play. And again, enjoyed the Historical Society episode on Psychoff when that came around. The master of metal mayhem.
He's hard out into alt country now.
Yep. Well, I think we go through phases.
Yeah, that's right.
But back then, it cost a bloody fortune to buy anything. It was all import. It was go down to Sounds Unlimited in Newmarket or Queen Street or Marbex and say, you know, I heard this record on the B. I want to pick it up. Okay, that'll take about 4 to 6 weeks and $25 of your hard-earned money. But one that I was very lucky that my dad forked out for, because it was a double import, Husker Du from Zen Arcade. Pink Turns to Blue was one that always stuck in my head. Could never point the lyrics completely until I got the actual record with the lyrics, but love the melody. It's a Grant Hart song. I'm probably more of a Bob Mould fan personally myself, but that one really stuck. So Husker Du, Pink Turns to Blue, my favorite from Zen Arcade back in about 1984.
There's a group that were played an awful lot on BFM in the 80s and early 90s. Huge.
Oh, yeah. And, yeah, New Day Rising would be blasting out, and they'd have an album, Flip Your Wig, after that, which I remember Chris Knox reviewing for the New Zealand Listener. And he said, basically, you know, if you're expecting New Day Rising, you're not going to find it here. There's all this melody, et cetera, et cetera. And, you know, they carried that through Variety until they broke up, and again, never made it down this way. Seen Bob play, I've seen Grant Hart play, but yeah, I doubt we'll be seeing them play together.
What year did they split up?
That was second album on Warner's, probably around 89, right. 88, yeah. 89.
So before the 90s even, yeah. They were over as a band.
Yeah, yeah. They went to Warner's. The sound got a bit more polished after the old SST indie label sort of thing. They did Candy Apple Grey, Warehouse Songs and Stories, and then that was it. Although, you know, Bob had some brilliant solo albums. He had Sugar. Gave a great interview to Andrew Black up here one afternoon. Very good to talk to. Seen him a few times in the States, along with many other great bands, among them a bunch of good Kiwi bands, of course. But yeah, particularly remember his show down here, as I mentioned, with Chris and Martin.
Now, did you fill in on other odd radio shows, like apart from the Wednesday special, which was your sort of your regular weekly slot, did you get the opportunity to do sort of other time slots?
I pretty much announced my availability to come and fill in and be useful in any which way, shape or form. Did the jazz show on a few occasions. Wow. That was great. Yeah. Good way to, you know, I often slotted a bit of jazz into my show. Didn't really think twice about sticking Billie Holiday beside Motorhead on a regular show. So being able to come in and play some of my favourite jazz tunes, the old Miles Davis, Dave Brubeck, yeah, and some of the New Zealand bands, of course, back in the day. Mm-hmm. And Nathan Haynes, of course, has shone through well over a decade's worth there. Filled in for, was it Land of the Good Groove?
For Murray Kamak.
Yep.
Wow,
yep.
Excellent.
And dusted off some of your funk and Motown and stuff.
Oh, absolutely. Always been a fan of that, you know, all over the place. OJs, Spinners. Just recently was lucky enough to see Gil Scott-Heron in New York City. Surprised he's still going, but he's back with a passion, it seems, recording new stuff. So, you know, the stuff people know, Revolution will not be televised, The Bottle. Yeah. Great stuff. So, again, a couple of hours goes by very fast when you're playing selections like that.
You kind of had a good presence on the radio, just doing other shows, you know, filling in here and there, and they could hear you at nighttime or at daytime, you know, as work or studies permitted and that sort of thing.
Oh, yeah, yeah. And it was great to see, of course, a lot of ex-BFM alumni were musicians in their own right, did a lot of recording up here, or were involved in bands or radio in some way, shape or form after BFM. A lot of them still involved. People like Paul Casserly, Mark Tierney, you know, a lot of producers started off here and went on to bigger, not necessarily better things, but, you know, it was an evolution. People like Watney Sideburns, that was a band that recorded up here, was released on one of the BFM cassette compilations. Featured Paul Casserly on drums, Gil Harris on guitar, no relation. Never heard from them again, only did one song as far as I'm aware, and I think it was back in the days when BFM used to recycle tape. So, yeah, noticed that one day going through the tape library. Oh, this looks like the Watney Sideburns master put it on. It was some jingles of some sort, rather. But, yeah, they had a great song, Rain Over You, which has stuck with me, and I know Renee plays it every now and then.
Let's play it.
When I see you walk past, I just burn up like a meteor. I lost my mind 1,000 times. I can't play this game no more. Think I'll wait in the clouds, and if you ever say how dry. Bye.
So that I really like the sound of that. Watney Sideburns recorded here in the BFM production studio, no doubt after hours, and incorporating various members of BFM staff and friends.
Good luck to you if you've got that. I know that at least two of the members of the band didn't have a copy, so I was more than happy to provide a copy of that from the cassette I had from way back in the day. I'm surprised I've still got it and it still runs. Twisted around a bit and it played fine.
Now, another production engineer that we had working here at BFM way back when was Michael Laurie.
So Michael Laurie, back in the day, and again, there's a long association of New Zealand bands metamorphosizing, etc., change a member, change a name, etc., etc. So way back in the day, there was a band called Children's Hour, which turned into the International Headless Chickens, which became the Headless Chickens. It's still one of my favourite bands, and Chris Matthews still going strong with his Robot Monkey Orchestra, another one that, you know, I consider a must-have. But yeah, the Headless Chickens' first EP was recorded largely, if not mostly, up in the BFM studios here, again, after hours. For the equipment we had back then, it wasn't shabby, but there's bloody solid results, as with most of the Flying Nun releases in the 80s. Keep it simple, you know, keep it clean. Headless Chickens back in the day, extremely heavy use of samplers, sequences, or whatever they were called back then. That sort of stuff was still pretty much in its infancy, alongside the live instrumentation and the great songs. You know, I was a huge Children's Hour fan. Again, good luck if you've got any of the original vinyl. It'll set you back quite a few pennies to pick up these days, the Flesh EP, the Washed Away single, etc. But the Headless Chickens' first EP, to me, is absolutely seminal. It ties in the BFM, it ties in Flying Nun, the New Zealand music scene, and just absolutely original music, as with a lot of the stuff coming out of the country then and now. Yeah, my one pick off that Headless Chickens EP. I love the whole thing, and I loved seeing it live last year at the Power Station and back in the day at the Power Station when it was usually after midnight. But Monkey Jar is the one with that pre-recorded, you know, sampled intro and just this evil, menacing groove that builds up. And I still wind up Chris Matthews about the fact that every issue of the song ever since the original EP has a fade out because he thought it was wanking on too long. And I said, well, what did the Beatles do with I Want You, She's So Heavy? It cut off clean. Headless Chickens, Monkey Jar.
What a blow for you, Kathy.
Yeah, and I really did think my world had come to an end.
And turn me upside down.
with secrets in me to bring. Turn you upside down till the wind dry. I don't want to hurt you, go home, dip some paint ash for the hands. I don't know what the fuss is all about.
Eventually, you left university, you did graduate, and it was time to get out there in the workforce.
After all the years of fun up here, but, you know, still kept involved with the station. You know, spent a lot of time up here, always very interested to see what the DJs were playing and breaking, because there was and is such diversity still on BFM. It is still the alternative for most people as to what's out on the commercial bands, even though there are a lot more, I think, more niche stations alongside out these days that people can tune into and jump around from. Back in the day, there wasn't such a thing, and BFM was it across the spectrum. There was a show for everything, and if there wasn't, then there were outlets like the Sunday Night Surprise and the Wednesday Night Special to fill it. And again, listening back through the Historical Society episodes to date, it's just amazing to see the choices that come out of the woodwork. And you think, well, if BFM had never played it, I'd probably never have heard it, because it wouldn't have been played on the mainstream. The vinyl was too darn expensive to import. If you knew about it, you had to read about it. Like, I can remember every time there was a Jam announcement of a new 7-inch coming in, people would go down to Sounds Unlimited and buy the things out. So
yeah, before you could get there, even.
That was the old days, absolutely. The amount of music that I was turned onto through the BFM DJs. Before we get to, you know, how I closed up the last, I think, hurrah of my time with BFM, you know, one of the tracks that stood out for me, absolutely sure I'd never have heard it if it wasn't for Graham Humphreys playing it on the radio, Graham Hill as he was in his BFM persona. It was off a Ralph Records compilation, Ralph Records mainly being famous for The Home of the Residents and Snakefinger. He had a copy of this Potatoes LP, and BFM probably had it at one stage, although it probably grew legs and walked out the door, because it's a very collectible piece of vinyl, then as is now. There was the likes of Snakefinger, etc. There was an uncredited one, Billy B. But the one that stuck to me was this absolutely haunting song called Canto del Peon, and it was Maria Marquez, who is, I believe she's a Venezuelan, lives in the Bay Area, sings Spanish songs. I actually was lucky enough to see her in San Francisco Bay Area playing a concert, and she did this song, and I'd talked to her before the show about it and had dedicated it to me, which was pretty special. So this is Canto del Peon. It's Maria Marquez with instrumentation from Frank Harris. It's available now on a CD and probably, of course, iTunes, etc. But back in the day, it was on an import-only record. Graham Hill had it. Great collection of stuff. It even had one of the guys from Devo in there. So Maria Marquez, Frank Harris, Canto del Peon.
Acabe de romper, y yo,
So at some point in the 90s, you got a job. What was that?
I'd actually graduated about half a year before I went out and got a real job. I'd come back and started a master's paper or two. Thought I should actually go and start earning a living with my education. Ended up with a statistics degree, I guess, science, and DHL hired me. Ended up straight in the IT department, nothing to do with statistics, straight into computers. So crash course in Unix, systems administration, user support, all that sort of thing. That was late 1995, and then, you know, through the remainder of the 90s, kept involved with B, did a few interviews, did a few shows to fill in the evenings, weekends, as I could. Definitely kept in touch with people as much as possible. Great to see the evolution of the station, you know, that 8-track that we were recording on up in BFM studio in the day was replaced early 90s by one of the country's first Pro Tools systems on a Mac. I think you could get about 75 minutes out of it at the time before you had to dump it down to DAT or tape and start recording again. But that was a quantum leap in what you could do in a shortened amount of time with the quality versus what was there on the 8-track. Drag and drop, copy and paste.
No more need for scalpels.
Yep. Finishing up at BFM, one of the last things I was really involved in that was a lot of time invested was what turned out to be the first ever documentary on a seminal New Zealand band, Split Enz. You know, it hadn't been done before. It was their 20th anniversary fast approaching. So put it to the powers that be. There was Graham, can't remember who the station manager was at the time. It might have been Harriet, actually. But we decided, yep, we'll go and do it. And, of course, with a budget of nothing, managed to set out with a couple of phone numbers, calling around, managed to get some in-person interviews. Neil Finn was very gracious as far as that's concerned, as was Tim, the ones that are over in Aussie, and managed to secure what was, I think, Phil Judd's first interview in many a year, actually talking about music rather than the artwork he was doing. And my initial interest in Split Enz was subliminal, I guess, as much as anything. My dad used to work with Wally Wilkinson, who was the original guitarist back in the day. He's now in Aussie with his software company. And we had a copy of Sweet Talkin' Spoon Song, backed with 129, later named Madeline Idol. Grew up with that, and of course there was the usual, you'd hear the Give It A Whirls and the Icy Reds, and then True Colours exploded onto the scene, and laser etchings and all, set for world domination, one would think, but no. We started getting into that. Mike Chun was absolutely invaluable at the time. He was running APRA, Australasian Performing Rights Association, the New Zealand office. Hooked me up with everybody, did the interviews, great source of material. In fact, what Split Enz unanimously considered their best work was largely completely unavailable. They're in the UK, they're in the bones of their backsides, about to be deported, you name it, you know, it was going wrong. No record company behind them, no gigs, and they got around that by booking some studio time in Luton and recorded what became known as the legendary Rootin' Tootin' Luton tapes. 1978, I think they did 28 or so songs. Again, very simple, 8-track recording. Noel was recording in the bathroom with his drums. There were people out in the hall, corridors, etc., etc. Just what they needed, and they considered those the demos for what became the Frenzy album, which was, you know, one of their most, I wouldn't say least commercial, but they were very unhappy with the end results. The so-called producer, Mallory Earle, in Neil's words pretty much, paraphrasing, didn't know his ass from his elbow. It was very upsetting. Icy Red was tagged onto that to try and make something out of it. But again, Mike Chun had some cassette copies of some of the songs. Some of them we were able to source from vinyl, B-sides of singles. Actually, overseas, the Frenzy album was completely remixed and reissued with some of these Rootin' Tootin' Lootin' tapes on side two. So that was source material. They've since, of course, all been discovered pretty much. Eddie Rayner's done a great job of remixing when they reissued the Split Enz catalogue. So you can get it out there. And if you're a member of Friends of the Enz, you can actually get the double CD version, which has everything they're able to find versus the one that's available in the shop. All that they could find. I'm not sure if all of them were there, but that was pretty much all they could find. Pretty much 2-year effort getting that documentary done. So Bill Curtin, who again had a great Historical Society show, was producing, and he'd come in, and if you'd listened to the episode, you'll know what his producing background was, but did a bloody great job. Graham Hill produced, I narrated, for want of a better word, had a great time doing it. Beer and pizza every Tuesday night or Monday night, can't remember, for the better part of 3 months, and at the end of it we had 12 half an hour episodes, which were played early 93 sequentially, I think it was every Saturday afternoon, and sent around the student radio, the BNet, to be played then. And then, of course, national radio followed up a few years later with a much more professional-sounding one. But, you know, I think we had the spirit, got the job done, and it was the first, which at the time was quite staggering to think no one had done. That was called Letters to My Friends. It was something made up from, not really the top of my head, but a quote from their Split Ends song. Back in the day, it was ENDS, and it was writing letters to my friends, telling them all about Split Ends, seminal New Zealand band, part of my history with BFM, you know, and hopefully it's the documentary then and the one that came after has turned a lot of people onto some older Split Ends they may not have been familiar with.
To hell.
since those days, tried to keep in much at hand in BFM as possible, moved overseas early 2000, January 2000, yeah. I think I did a show, came up visit Peter Ehrlich, doing Nice and Ehrlich with Bevan Keys, I think it was the weekend before I buggered off to the US. Of course, BFM these days, technologically, not only does it broadcast a lot louder than it used to on the FM dial, but you can hear it on the interwebs all around the world, so BFM Graveyard shows become my breakfast show, etc., etc. Troy's Rock and Roll Wire on a Friday afternoon is my Thursday night rock out, you know, with a couple of quiet beverages.
Again, that was another thing that BFM got on very, very early. And, I mean, it's funny considering we don't have a great deal of resources here. The fact that we had one of the first Pro Tools setups in the country is amazing. And then we were one of the very first New Zealand radio stations, or in fact in the world, to live stream via the internet.
Definitely a credit to BFM and the programming here in the years that I have been away from New Zealand, that I still source most of my new UK and US music from listening to BFM versus any forum/media in the US. So I think that's testimony unto itself of BFM, you know, 40 years, still growing. It's got to evolve, you know, not everyone might be happy with the direction it goes or what's going on, but, you know, it's an evolution. It's got to grow.
You're living in Chicago now?
I'm Chicago now. Started off a couple of years in San Francisco, living there actually at the same time as probably Andrew Boak and Lisa Vanderard, but I was unaware of it, so didn't get to catch up with them. And 4 years in Phoenix, 2.5 years in Chicago, and I calculated I've probably seen a good 500 or so concerts in the 9 or so years I've been over there. But, you know, the variety out there. But having said that, I curse quite frequently when I see some of the gigs that the New Zealand bands are playing locally around the country here, and think, damn, I wish I was at that Blam 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 gig,
or
this, that, or the other. You know, I was too young to see them back in the day. Seen the Mutton Birds, seen the Front Lawn, never saw Blam Blam Blam. So, Don, I'm going to have to hit you up for that one of these days.
There you go.
Yeah, I hear they do weddings now.
Yeah, that's right. Oh, it's really cool that you've stayed in touch too, Owen, and that you you know, you listen to BFM still, and also kind of stay in touch with people who are up on the station.
Oh no, it's been great influence on me musically as well as personally.
I remember you would call things in on the Rock and Roll Wire too, like you'd go and see a particularly interesting concert in the States. So you'd give Troy a call and give him a quick review of what the concert was like, and that sort of thing.
Except those quick reviews, because of the amount of concerts I was seeing, and I guess the variety, tended to turn into more like 5 or 10 minute monologues. But, you know, again, some seminal moments in my live music history over there. Saw the Pixies just after they'd reformed at Coachella. I've seen Radiohead a bunch of times, although I don't think they've been back to New Zealand since 98 when they were touring. OK Computer, Gil Scott-Heron, as I said. I've seen some great jazz people. There was a Coltrane 75th birthday concert in San Francisco where I saw, who were they? Tommy Flanagan, McCoy Tyner, and Pharoah Sanders together and with their individual bands doing Coltrane all night. And then the next week, literally, Tommy Flanagan passed away. So
Wow. You
just never know, and you got to take advantage. So I try to avoid staying home when there's a good gig on, over in the States and back home here in New Zealand. Probably the best or worst, depending which way you look at it, was seeing Nina Simone in the Bay Area and then driving an hour to see Shuggy Otis in his supposed comeback at the Fillmore. So
on the same night.
Yeah.
Excellent.
And, but again, some of the better concerts I've seen in the States have been New Zealand bands. I saw The Clean do a stonking show, 2001, Bottom of the Hill, San Francisco. And the opening bands there, A Night of Serious Drinking, turned on to them. So again, New Zealand music has led me on to other musical discoveries one way or another. I guess, you know, in some ways I definitely grew up with BFM. You know, I wasn't around in the early days when it was a pirate station broadcasting out of the bowels of Auckland University. I was here when it was broadcasting out of, not quite the bowels, but it's actually where the toilet is now in BFM across the hall. It was a small, it's had its infancy, it's had its, you know, time out, you know, it used to close down every night or when someone was hot on the trail. Back then, it used to be university terms only. You didn't have it through the school holidays, which wasn't much fun if you're actually looking for something to listen to back then, or not old enough to go out to the clubs and hear the bands actually do the live gigs. But again, the teenage years where it started to mature, got a bit wild, diversified. The subscription radio, the B-card, you know, what a great idea it was back in the day. A way to get revenue into the station without necessarily having to quote-unquote sell out, as a lot of people thought back then. And it was user-funded, user-driven, and, you know, hopefully it'll still continue to be driven by, you know, what the audience is wanting to hear, as well as what they don't even know they want to hear, and individual DJs bringing that music to their attention just through their own likes. And these days, of course, it's so much simpler than it was back then. But the catch is you've got so much more to wade through and find what, you know, fits into the BFM mold. I don't know if there is a BFM sound, but BFM has always been a forum for the new and the challenging. And yeah, I just hope it continues to mature and grow with the audience, as well as bringing on the new punters.
You have been listening to the BFM Historical Society, a weekly documentary series made to commemorate BFM's 40th anniversary. The Historical Society airs every Saturday morning at 11 a.m. and is replayed as a podcast from BFM's website later on in the week. The BFM Historical Society is produced at BFM by Dubhead.